thinks there's a possibility for randomness, random things to happen? Okay, that's one. If I throw a tennis ball at a wall, I don't know where it's going to land. Is that random? Random. Well, I throw it at a ball. I don't know where I throw a ball at a wall, and I don't know where it's going to land. So for me, it's a random possibility, isn't it? But as Paul said, it's not random because I can actually factor in from the angle of the throw exactly where it's going to land: the air temperature, humidity, angle of the ball, angle of the wall, the roughness of the wall, everything. I can factor it in. Because someone said that to me once. They said, oh, all things are random. If I throw a ball at a wall, I don't know where it's going to land. You only don't know where it's going to land because you only have a small part of the picture. Sorry? What? You don't know, but it can be plotted. We do know where it is. But you think there's a possibility for randomness. Give me an example. Not likely, exactly at that point.
And the more detailed you model it, the more correct.
That's correct.
Except that there's quantum physics, which has shown that there's things that we that are actually randomly, like electrons appear.
It appears that way, but if things were actually random, we could not plot anything ever. I'm creating the cause through even having the thought to throw it. If we have the possibilities of randomness and cause and effect, then what do we have? We actually have randomness, don't we?
No.
So if there's an interaction, okay, go on.
You know why I'm saying this? Because I didn't say this talk a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah.
And when you said, I was like, yeah, I remember that you talked about.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And I remember that I was telling this because I really believe, and I'm saying this to my friends, that there has to be randomness. There can't be a combination of randomness and
cause and effect. Because that's randomness.
Well, but, this is what my friend was saying.
Yeah.
Unless the randomness was constrained within a predictable sphere of cause and effect.
Isn't that cause and effect?
No, because within that sphere is random.
I'm not with you on that one.
Okay, so for example, if there is, there's cause and effect, which you take a ball, you put a force on it, right? So that's cause and effect, right? But then there is certain things that are random, like the movement of electrons, which can...
In quantum physics, yes. My observance of electron influences it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, isn't that cause and effect? Creates a cause, doesn't it?
Right.
It's a cause which creates the effect.
Electron, like a day later, the effect does matter.
Well, then how within quantum physics can things... How in quantum physics? We've got a debate going. This is good. How in quantum physics can anything ever be predicted then? Everything's completely random in quantum physics.
No, but you can predict at some level, like with Newtonian physics.
Okay. The point I'm making is, with the greater amount of knowledge, of understanding, can't we predict things more finely? Isn't it just that at this point in time we don't have all the facts about quantum physics, and therefore it's random. That the more we observe, who are the physics people in here? You? Yeah? Anyone else? What do you agree, do you agree with that or not?
Well, I was, you just said what I was thinking about, because we're not able to describe that mathematically at the moment. Calling it random for now can help, but you'll say this is random, of course, and I have to join the net as well, because you actually, it's random to yourself because you don't know, but it's not actually random.
That's right, yeah, that's the point that I was trying to make, yeah.
With time, we can learn these things. People are doing a lot of their master's or PhDs in mathematics, where like trying to have a formula that shows the blades of grass in the giant field actually are following a pattern. I met somebody who's doing their PhD in that.
That's great.
And it's brilliant because I think that's sort of a testament to the fact that I'm not quite sure random is pretty dumb. Yeah, but we can't prove that it's.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay, listen, I'm gonna say something about proving something. nothing is provable. Prove to me that that's the lid of a cup. No, it's an orange. I am totally convinced that that's an orange. Now prove to me that it's the lid of a cup. Impossible. There's only, this is in terms of proof, I cannot prove to you that karma exists. I cannot possibly do it. Impossible for me to prove that. There is a knowledge, according to Buddhism, where one knows that at the level of a Buddha, one knows cause and effect. What we're talking about here is theory. It's not provable. The only thing that, interestingly enough, we're going to get diverged here, but it doesn't matter. This is part of the debate. The only thing that's provable that I've come across is emptiness. I can prove to you that is not the lid of a cup or an orange. How? Because I can dissect it. And I can keep dissecting it until I get to atom level, and if I can go further than that, I will. And I can prove there is not one atom in there that is a cup, a lid of a cup. So the very interesting thing, the subtlest view of, and we're getting into emptiness now, but it doesn't matter, the subtlest view of Buddhism of the emptiness of an inherent existence is actually the only provable thing that we can do. We can prove something doesn't exist, we can't prove that it does exist. I can't prove, if you have a set of tenets that believes this is a table, that's fine. But if I have a set of tenets that doesn't believe it's a table, you can't prove it to me. You say, oh, look, it functions a table. Oh, yeah, I don't know what a table is. You're going to explain it infinitely, but I can say to you, I can prove that whatever you call as a table has not one atom in it that of a table. So the reason I'm saying this is to just to cut the level ground. I can't prove to you that karma exists. I will discuss karma within the Buddhist context, but I can't prove to you that it exists, because there is no way that I can show it. There's no way. I can throw a ball at a wall and you can say that's random, and I can say, well, it's predictable, and we can come up with a theory that's reasonable on there. But what I'm talking about now is a knowledge that actually a Buddha has, and it's a knowing. The interesting thing about the difference, one of the differences between a Buddha and us, or me, you might all be Buddhas, and you're just here to help me talk about it. The one point that is the difference between myself and a Buddha is that I think and a Buddha knows. So with a mind that's omniscient and connected with every particle of the universe, there's only one thing a Buddha can't do, and that's get lost. So the idea behind this is that there is a certain level of thinking for us humans, whereas a Buddha actually knows. A Buddha doesn't think. But Buddha doesn't think, because according to the tenets of Buddhism, and again the tenets of Buddhism, this could be argued, that a Buddha's mind knows all phenomena. And this is the extraordinary thing about enlightenment. A Buddha's mind knows all of phenomena, its emptiness and inherent existence, all at the one moment. this is the amazing thing. When I came across Buddhism, this was the amazing thing, that we actually have the potential of our own consciousness of actually achieving that level of realization, where every phenomena within the universe at every level is explainable. And the Buddha said something very interesting in his one of his talks. He said, there are many, many things I could show you, but they're irrelevant. He said, what's relevant is you escaping suffering. So he gave the Four Noble Truths. So maybe he could explain in great detail, and in fact it actually has been said that in one of the early schools of Buddhism, the Buddha explained to a group of people about the existence of atoms. He actually explained that. It was called the atomist view, because those people couldn't believe anything else. So he said, well, actually there's a small particle of matter called an atom, and he actually did explain it. Even something quite incredible that I came across to show the level of realizations in the Potala Palace in Lhasa, there is a depiction on the wall, I think it's the 14th or 15th century, it might be 16th century, of a sperm and egg developing into a human being. How is that possible? Don't know. So this is one depiction on this wall in the Potala. There's a sperm and egg, 14th, 15th century, of them growing into cells. Don't know. So, you know, there's miracles all around. Okay, the point being, I'll get back to karma now. Karma is cause and effect, and we run our lives by it. We really run our lives by it. Because if we had, and I won't get into quantum physics anymore, but if we planted a seed and it turned into Mercedes Benz, then we have serious randomness. It would be quite good, except we might want to eat apples. And so we run our lives by this predictability of karma, of cause and effect. But really what karma is really about, and this is where it's important, is according to Buddhist tenets, if we create a positive cause, we will have a positive result. So the whole of Buddhism, in a sense, is divided into what creates a negative result and what creates a positive result. Create things that create a positive result for ourselves and others, and avoid the things that create a negative result for ourselves and others. There you have it. That's the practice of Buddhism, really, literally. We run our lives by karmic choices, and we run our lives by making karmic decisions that will have an effect later on. One of the biggest problems with karma is that there is a gap between the cause and the effect. So people often think, oh well, big deal, I didn't get caught. Yeah, you're going to say something? Yeah, I mean, if we were cheating on our tax return and our bank account was going down at the same level, we would stop immediately. We do not see the gap. And what? Why is there a gap? Do you know why there's a gap? What allows the effect to function? Do you know? Conditions. And this is really, really important. These are the keys to actually living our lives, the conditions. There was a guy I knew many years ago in my martial arts travels, and he was a Wing Chun practitioner. Are there any Wing Chun practitioners here? Some of you know what it is. It's a very effective Chinese martial art. And this guy had come from New York, and we were doing a practice called Sticky Hands. And he was incredibly good. And his question to me was, how many fights do you get in? And I said, none. He said, what do you mean? He said, I always get in fights. He said, in fact, I'm always fighting. And I said, no, I don't never get fights. And I thought this was very puzzling. He even had a scar on his head. He said, oh, this is where a guy hit me with an umbrella and just missed the eye. He said, I had to fight three guys in New York before I left. And a while later, I was talking to someone, and I was talking about this guy, and they said, I said, this is bizarre. This guy always seems to be having to fight. And he said, yeah. He said, I was at a party, and I saw him walk into a party. He was creating the cause with that agitated mind to end up having a battle with somebody. You walk into a party and look around for someone that's going to fight you, you've already created the link. Now, that's not to say that you can walk into a party peacefully and someone beats you up. I'm not saying that that's not a possibility. But what I'm saying is that state of mind is the fertile ground or the conditions for negative things to happen. So if you want negative things to happen to you, develop a mind that is angry, agitated, fearful, greedy, miserly, and already you're creating the fertile ground for negative karma to arrive. And again, that doesn't mean that things, bad things don't happen to good people. I'm not saying that, but yeah, just for. According to Buddhist thought, whatever happens to you is a result of karma. And it's, people say, oh, that's really unfair. But
most people can't actually get, they can't consciously create good or bad karma in this life.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate. Because we have three possibilities of karma. We have positive, negative, and neutral. Well, according to the karmic theory, When that karma has finished, when the effect of that karma is finished, other karmas ripen. It depends. Generally that's the conditions. But when you look at the span, if according to Buddhist thought, that we have had beginningless lives, there has been no beginning to our consciousness, then the possibilities of us transcending experiencing every state of existence, from mental illness to whatever, to being a king, to being incredibly wealthy, to going through the six realms of existence, there's all that possibility. Because when you have beginningless time of consciousness and beginningless rebirths, then you have beginningless possibilities, infinite possibilities of having changes of existence. And that's really what the Buddha said. We are continually spinning around in samsara. We're going from high rebirth to low rebirth to high rebirth, continuing on. And his Four Noble Truths were, there is suffering and dissatisfaction. There is a cause of that, us. Not a supreme being that is going, okay, you win, you lose, but it's our creation. We're creating. We are creating our own suffering. We are creating our own mental patterns. So there's suffering, which is can be also translated as dissatisfaction. It's a bit cold, it's a bit hot, always dissatisfaction. They talk about changeable suffering in terms of you're lying on the sand and it's fantastic, it's a beautiful hot day and the sea's there, and all of a sudden you really start to sweat. Oh. So you dive in the water and you feel, oh, this is fantastic, I feel fabulous. Then you start to get really cold. I hope this doesn't ruin day at the beach for you, but it gets really cold. And then you go out along the sand and you go, oh, this is fantastic. Oh, then you get really hot. So it's said that this pleasure is actually just changeable suffering. We read it as pleasure, but in fact what we're actually doing is just changing one degree of suffering to another. We kind of do that. That's the dissatisfaction that we often don't realise. We call it pleasure, but in fact it can be just changeable suffering. So the Buddha said, okay, so there's suffering, there's a cause of suffering, and then, the good news, there is a way out of suffering, and there is a cessation to that suffering. And he basically said, I cracked it. I did this, and I'll show you how to do it. I can't take your suffering from you. I can't transmute it. I can't remove it. But I can show you how to get out of it yourself. And the way to get out of it is to purify those karmic negative effects by continually work on the positive balance until eventually you see the clarity, or you get the clarity of not being involved with this ego grasping, which wants to be cut, to be completely involved with becoming all the time, to existing all the time, the letting go. There's a great line, I can't remember, it was a Theravada monk who said, if you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will have complete peace. Now, do you know really what that means? What that letting go is? It's letting go this agitation of existence, of greed, of wanting, of I want, I don't want. And we continually in this battle, this continual battle of I want and I don't want. And therefore, within that battle, we create karmic causes and effects, which end up in the next cycle. So in a sense, the cycle of rebirth is actually the cycle of connecting karmas, of connecting one karma to the next. If someone comes up and abuses you, how are you going to achieve in a future time that that person doesn't abuse you again? Okay, we're not going in there. We won't go there, Paul. We'll talk about emptiness another night. Because emptiness proves that there is no inherent existence. However, the Buddha talked about relative existence. Now, I can say to you that this cup is empty of inherent existence, but if I bounce it off your skull, you will go, ouch, I promise you. Alright? So you've got to be careful with the emptiness. It doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, it just doesn't exist inherently. Right? Karma doesn't exist inherently, but it's a real fact for us that haven't transcended the realization of emptiness with karma. Okay. So, in cause and effect, I've kind of lost my train of thought. In cause and effect, you have this beginning cause and you have the effect. You have the conditions that bring it through. If you allow yourself to recognize that, then you will do something about the conditions to not let negative karma keep ripening. If you think about a person who's a gangster, they run around their whole lives trying to control their fate, and you hear it constantly how they end up either in jail or dead. Oh, well, you shot my gang member, I'm going to go and shoot your gang member, and then I get shot. You know, particularly what happened in Melbourne a few years ago, everyone was shooting everybody. You know, the person that stepped away and goes, I'm not actually going to shoot. Oh, that's the point that I was going to make. Yeah, if you want a negative person to leave your life and you don't want them to return again as a negative person, then don't create the interaction of that karma where that person is being negative to you. Don't start it off again. And there's a story in the Jataka Tales of a previous life of the Buddha. And he was an ascetic living in a forest, like a hermit, yogi. And a king and his wife were riding in the forest. The king's party were hunting, and the king's wife got bored. So she wandered off into the bush, and she found this old yogi sitting under a tree. And she started asking him questions, and he was talking about, this was a previous incarnation of the Buddha, and he started talking about various things. And the king came along and was absolutely furious and accused this yogi of fooling around with his wife. Now, the Buddha was relating this as a previous life, and this king then tied up this poor old monk, or whatever he was, yogi, and started torturing him, cutting off bits of flesh and cut him into pieces in front of the wife. And the question from the Buddha's disciple was, weren't you upset? Didn't it hurt? And he said, yeah, it really hurt. But he said, there was no way I was going to be angry at the king because I didn't want it to happen again. It had already happened worse. I'd created the karma. He was wise enough to... He realised he'd created the karma for that conditions to ripen. And he said, there was no way I was going to repeat that and end up having it happen twice. So what I did was send the king loving thoughts. That's a tough call, I have to tell you. But that was the way the Buddha explained karma. So every moment that we're experiencing, right here and now, has come from a previous cause. And every moment that we're going to experience in the future is coming from a cause that we're making now. So there's this, and this is why they say only a Buddha can see the action of karma. There's this constant interaction. And this is where the practice of mindfulness comes in. What's happening right now to us? Are we thinking negative thoughts? Are we doing negative actions? Because those are going to ripen. And they're going to ripen in a situation that won't be pleasant if we're creating negativity. So, very simply, watch what you're doing moment by moment, and you will have a possibility of creating positive effects. And in effect, as one monk said to me once, he said, every time you do a negative action, he said, you bind yourself to samsara. Every time you do a positive action, you free yourself a little bit. And the more positive actions you can do, the more you free yourself. And you think about what a positive action is. Generosity. You become generous, or you create generosity. There's no negative in that. You feel good about it anyway. So that's a positive action. It's beneficial for yourself and others. True. So we have to watch our mind. I'm going to give you this present because I hope you're going to give me a really good present later on. I wouldn't call that generosity. That's greed. But honestly, truthfully, there is always that quality in everything that we do. As human beings that haven't seen the emptiness of inherent existence directly, there's always a certain degree of selfishness in it. In other words, when we give a present and someone says thank you, we go, oh, that's nice. There isn't a problem with that. There isn't a problem. You don't give a present and go, no, I'm not going to feel anything. That's the natural interaction. Eventually it gets to a point where we see the non-inherent existence of phenomena where it doesn't matter. This is the same as that, is the same as that. If everything is empty, then there is no attachment to it. And then we can give actually freely, with complete non-attachment to it. But up until that point, we're still going to have a level of attachment. Oh, well, I'm slightly attached, therefore I'm not going to be kind to that person because I've got some reward in it. So that's crazy thinking. In other words, we try to create as much positivity as we can. And when we lose it, when it doesn't happen correctly for us or we get angry, we try and drop it as quickly as possible. And one teacher said once in a lecture that I was listening to, one Buddhist teacher, he said, if you want to know how your progress is going with your practice, see how fast you drop something. In other words, an emotion. If you just see how fast, he said, if your emotions slide off you like water off oil, he said, you're probably doing pretty well. He said one student he had who he was disciplining rather strongly was only smiling. He said, the more I got angry with them, the more they were smiling. He said, they said it was like a blessing because they knew that the teacher was disciplining them for a particular reason. That's a pretty high level. Maybe we're not at that level. But if we recognise that the previous causes we're having are acting on us all the time, then we can let go this, oh, why is this happening to me? And I remember a Jewish person telling me this, and I think this was very difficult for them. They said during the Holocaust, some Jewish people found it very, very difficult to deal with, because they couldn't rationalise that a loving God could cause their people to suffer so much. Buddhists don't actually have that problem. Truly. If it's happening to us, it's a previous mind stream consciousness that caused this thing, and actually I just have to deal with it. It doesn't make it mean it any pleasant, but at least we don't have the confusion that there is someone else doing it to us. Because if there's someone out there doing it to us, we have no control over our lives. Yep. Maybe he has transcended birth and rebirth. I know. I'm not saying. I said maybe he has. I'm not saying what he says. He just says his stuff. But no, I don't know. There is a point. Look, I really do believe that you can escape samsara. I'm a Buddhist, and I really do believe that. But that's my belief. I can't prove it to anyone. But I really believe, from a Buddhist perspective, that what the Buddha said was correct. The reason I can say that is because after 30 years of practice, I have seen some small things work. Nothing major, but I have seen some small things work. I've seen that when I've let go stuff and forgiven people and been generous, that my life seems to have a bit more harmony. And I find there is some happiness in my life. Not all the time, things go wrong too. But I find that when I work with my mind and meditate and try to keep my mind calm, I experience a different quality of life than when, before I was a Buddhist, when my mind was agitated and I didn't know what was going on. So I say, from my personal experience, there has been some change. And so therefore I have some faith in the practices that I've done and I've been given, that there is some positive effect. And that's all I can say. And I'm sure some of you have found the same thing. Some of you who meditate go, yeah, when I meditate and my mind feels peaceful and calm, I'm really in a kind of a really nice state. And in the, if you remember, I can't remember her name, in the Mitra conference, there was a Thai nun, an older woman, and they said, well, what's happiness for you? You know, we hear this word happiness, what's happiness? And I thought it was just such a great answer. She said, at the end of the day, if I look back and I realised that I have done things with virtuous thought and a positive mind for a whole day, she said, then I'm really happy. And she said, but it's not a happiness that's a whoopee, it's like a great contentment that I've lived a whole day in the best possible way that I could do it. Not from a, you know, I went out and had cream cakes and great scones and a great cup of tea and food, but that actually lived in a positive way, so that I could look back on the whole day and say, that actually was really good. She said, then I have actually a happy life. And she said, I do that day by day, and I thought that was really good. Not, oh, you know, I've done these amazing things, but that I've actually acted in accord with a positive attitude and a positive mind and a positive motivation for the whole day. And if we can do that, then actually we do have happy lives. You can feel content that you've done the best you can. And that's something also I recognise too, when people sometimes come to me for counselling and they go, oh, you know, things aren't going well, and I say to them, are you doing the best you can with what you've got? Some people say, nah. I say, well, okay, get on the horse and start riding it, because you need to pick your act up. If they say, yeah, I'm doing the best I can with what I've got, I said, then you can relax. If you're doing the best you can with what you have, then that's the best you can do. And I'll tell you an interesting story for this happened to me. And it was kind of something that was quite unusual. I was given, I'd been in security for the Dalai Lama in 1982, and I'd been involved with security, but in 1996 I was asked to be head of security for the Dalai Lama for the Kalachakra tour of 10 days, and he was giving a Kalachakra initiation. and I had to have 82 security people, and I had to run it. And we had 24-hour security for 10 days, and I had to have 12 people on the floor all day, and at least a team overnight. And I had never used a computer in 1996. I had never touched a computer. So they said to me, you need to get on email, and you need a computer. We're dropping one round to your house, your apartment. A guy knocks on the door, he brings the computer in. I said, how's it work? He said, there's the on button, and walked out the door. So, now, you know, all of you use computers. How helpful is that? So, I turned the on button in, on, and I started pressing buttons. And I rang people, and I spent 10 hours pressing that keyboard, finding out how not to work a computer. Anyway, in the end, I got email up and running. I think I'm doing really well. And then someone says to me, how are you going to log on these 82 people? Because everyone had sent in their form that said, I can work for 2 hours on a Friday, but then I've got to go on a dental appointment, so I won't be there on... I won't be there for 2 hours on that night, and then I'm going to be here on a Tuesday. So I had this stack of 82 pages of everyone with a different decision on when they were going to be available, because they were all volunteers. And I thought, and someone says, just put it on an Excel spreadsheet. A what? Just use Excel, huh? It's on your computer. Just log it on. And so this is a Friday morning. I had a massage client coming. I'm sitting there going, Excel. And I just went, oh my goodness, I can't do this. I absolutely can't do this. This is absolutely beyond my ability to work out how to type. I couldn't type for a start. It's like, where's the E? And so I had this back of the, and I'm going... And I'm sitting there going, I've got 3 weeks to get this out, to give everyone their schedule, when to arrive, where to arrive, and I can't do it. So, I sat there and I went, listen here, Buddhas, this is true. I can't do this. The Dalai Lama is coming here for the benefit of all sentient beings, and I can't do it. So I actually have to hand this over to him. I need help. Oh, client. Okay. Open the door. Client walks in. Hi, how are you? I'm fine. I had the mat ready. I was doing shiatsu for her. She said, how are you? I said, actually, I'm not very good. I was kind of smiling because it was just... It had got to the point where, you know, where you get to the point where everything collapses and you just got to smile because there's just nowhere else to go. And I was kind of smiling and I said, actually, I'm not really very good. And she said, why not? I said, well, I'll tell you what I've got to do. I've got 82 people with everyone with a different agenda. I've got to log them onto an Excel spreadsheet and send out their things for appointments. And I don't know how to do it. And I really don't know what to do about it. So I said, I'm kind of really... a bit confused, but you know, anyway. And she started to smile at me. And I said, what are you smiling at? She said, give me them. I said, what do you mean? She said, give them to me. I said, why? She said, you don't know what I do. I said, no, I don't know what you do. She said, I'm the HR manager for a huge computer company. I do this stuff all the time. I'll have it for you on Monday on a disc. And I went, what? She said, yeah. 7:30 on Monday morning, she said, my husband's a computer programmer. He reckoned this 3D model was the most difficult he's ever looked at in his entire life. We nearly had a marriage breakdown by Sunday evening, but here it is. She said, just throw it in your computer and print it out. Now, isn't that incredible? So, sometimes, karmically, things do work out. And it's the truth. It absolutely happened. And to this day, I still see her. Now, that was 1996. And I still say to her, do you realise what you did? She went, no. You know, she knows the story, but she doesn't think it's, she didn't think it was some any big deal. I was seeing a miracle happen in front of me. So sometimes also, and this is what I'm saying, sometimes when you get to the point where you're doing the best you can, sometimes you also just actually have to ask for help. And somewhere in my karmic life, I had created some cause for that woman to walk through that door at that time and actually sort something out. And the whole thing worked perfectly and everyone got to their rosters and everything was fine. So we have to recognise that we can create causes and we can have positive motivations, and they do work for us. They do work. Now, there's some interesting things about karmas, and I'll get into more detail now. There are things called complete karmas, where you create a complete or effect karma, which will definitely ripen as the cause. And there are four conditions for that to happen. Firstly, you have to have the object. Did you know that you can't create karma with an inanimate object? You can only create karma in relation to other sentient beings. So, if that didn't belong to anyone, and I abused it by yelling at it, it would not create any full karma. It would create an agitation in my own mind and maybe a negative feeling and maybe have some effect, but it's not creating a full karma. So a full karma is in relationship to another sentient being. Killing, stealing, lying, sexual misconduct, all those things are related to another sentient being. So you have to have the object, and the object is another sentient being. You have to have the intention of doing something. You have to do the act, it has to be completed, and you have to feel satisfied that you've completed it. That is a full throwing karma. It will result in a rebirth. Interestingly, and these are according to the laws of Buddhism, how Buddhism understands karma. If I decide to shoot someone, I have the intention, I have the object, I have the intention, I shoot, but I actually miss and kill somebody else. I've created a negative karma, but I haven't created a full negative karma. So it's not clear how that's going to ripen in terms of cause and effect. And this is just detailed stuff. So there are kind of loose karmas out there that can ripen at various times, but not necessarily ripen as a complete rebirth. So you have to have those four factors. Now, very interesting thing about purification. So I've created a complete karma. The object, the intention, the act, and the completion. If I regret every negative action that I have ever done, constantly going, whatever indiscretion I have done in terms of this, I wish never to repeat and not do it again, you're actually taking one of those factors away. This is actually how you purify karma. So if you've done a negative action towards someone and you realise it's a negative action, and we do it sometimes not intentionally but sometimes intentionally, if you create another action and regret that first action and you do some penance for it, and I'll give you an example. There was a guy who was involved in the Vietnam War, an Australian, and he very much regretted being involved in it. He was quite horrified by the fact that he'd been conscripted. And he went to this teacher and he said, you know, he became a Buddhist, he wasn't at the time when he was in the war. And he went to a Buddhist teacher and he said, when I was a young man, I was in the Vietnam War, and he said, I don't know for sure, but I think I might have killed someone and I feel great regret for that. So the Lama said to him, well, save something. Go and save something. So he went out and found a farmer and said, I want to buy 10 sheep and I want you to look after them for the rest of their natural lives as an intention and as a payback of saving a sentient life, because they were fat lambs or something. Little did he know they lived for about 20 years. It cost him a lot of money. But he did that as an action to regret the causes and conditions that he created in the previous life. I had a similar thing happen to me with a pigeon. A pigeon arrived on my doorstep. And when I was young, I wasn't a Buddhist, and I would kill ants and mosquitoes and didn't care. It didn't matter to me. Squash a mosquito. And I realised when I became Buddhist that I'd probably killed a lot of sentient beings. So this one opportunity happened. One day I came home. This is about probably about six years ago. Came home and there was a pigeon sitting on my doorstep, and it had actually walked up three flights of stairs. We were in a top floor unit. And I'm thinking, there's a pigeon sitting there. I thought, oh well, I'll give it some seed and water. Didn't know if it was injured. It was just sitting there. I thought it might have been cold or something. And then I found the next morning was still sitting there. I thought, uh-oh. So I rang up a vet, and the vet said, oh, well, if you bring a pigeon in, we'll just put it down. And I thought, uh-oh, now I've got a problem. So the vet said, however, there is, over here in Alexandria, there's a guy that looks after birds. He's a bird vet. Why don't you take it there? So I put the pigeon in the box, kept growling. Did you know pigeons growl? So I put the pigeon in the box, decided to call it Daisy. It seemed like a good name. went off to the bird doctor, and I walk in, and the nurse took it and went and came back, and the doctor came out, and he said, look, this pigeon has a very bad broken wing. We would actually amputate that on any normal bird. However, we really put pigeons down because they're not, you know, not a native animal. And I said, oh, I have a real problem with that. And he said, why? I said, well, I'll be truthful. I said, I really don't want it killed. I'm a Buddhist and I don't believe in killing things. Thinking, oh, here we go. He goes, oh, right. He said, actually, I'm Jewish, but my wife's Chinese. And he said, I worked in Hong Kong. And he said, I totally understand where you're coming from. He said, I totally understand you're a Buddhist because my mother-in-law's a Buddhist and she would do exactly the same thing. He said, if it was your bird, then you would have a right to save it, wouldn't you? If it was your bird. I said, okay, it's my bird. He said, good. He said, it's going to cost you $700 and we'll amputate the wing, and now you have a pigeon for the rest of your life, its life. And I said, do it. Because I said to myself, this is an opportunity right here and now of, in a sense, paying for, with clear intention, all the killings that I had done in my youth as stamping on ants or squashing mosquitoes or whatever. So here's a perfect opportunity. He came out, he said, I'm giving you a $200 discount anyway. He said, I think it's fantastic that you're doing this. The nurse came out and said, that's great, I'm really pleased you're doing this. No one ever saves pigeons. They love birds. They didn't care what kind of bird it was. Here we discriminate good bird, bad bird. Birds are birds, they're sentient beings. So I went away, I went home, I looked up pigeon.com and find out that pigeons live for 35 years, some of them, if they're well looked after. I'm going, oh no, I have just inherited pigeon. Not only that, a pigeon can fill its cage with droppings in about 2 hours. So I had to clean. So I got the pigeon home. I had to clean the pigeon cage out twice a day. I had to give it antibiotics. Every time I put it in a towel to give it antibiotics, it'd growl at me. And I'm thinking, oh no, oh well, this is my lot, this is the penance, I'm going to have to look after a pigeon, clean its cage out every day for the next 35 years. I was telling a friend this who was involved in wires, and they said, leave it with me. They rang me, they said, oh, I've just found someone on the north coast of Kempsey who has a one-winged pigeon that needs company. Oh, and a one-winged seagull called Eric. And they really want your pigeon. Would you be willing to give your pigeon. I said, yeah, well, it's a tough call, but okay. I'll give my pigeon to this. And she was so happy, and I sent up $300 for feed, and the pigeon went up to live in the North Coast. And she sent me pictures of the, and she said, boy, did they bond, these two one-winged pigeons wandering around together. There is a bit of a sad story. Unfortunately, 6 months later, they were killed by a goshawk, and she was really upset that she didn't want to tell me. And she, I rang her and said, how's the pigeon? She said, oh, I couldn't ring you, I'm so upset. They were killed, a hawk got in and killed them both. But she said they had the best lives for quite a few months together. They were really happy. So, unfortunately, it was a sad end, but I did the best I could. I couldn't prevent that happening, and she couldn't prevent it happening. But in the end, I felt like I'd done the right job. Yep?
Do you think that the benefit to yourself of looking after that pigeon, like the benefit in terms of taking away your karma, was in any way diminished by the fact that your intention was to take away your karma?
Yeah, possibly at some level there was some grasping there. But I also really wanted to save the pigeon. So there was, yeah, and this is why I was saying earlier, there was still some ego grasping in there. Absolutely. I won't say there wasn't. There was a thing saying, gosh, I've got a chance to purify some karma. But also, too, I also do want to reach, and this is true, it's a personal thing, I do want to reach a higher level where I can help more people. And I realised that getting more wisdom and knowledge by purifying karma is going to be beneficial there. So it's a bit of both, but I will say, yes, definitely there would be some diminishing of that on ego grasping level, and I certainly admit that. When I'm a Buddha, hopefully I won't have that level. In fact, if I do become a Buddha, I won't have that level. But yes, there is always that, and this is why I explained earlier, there's always that payoff. But that doesn't mean that you don't do a good act. This is the point that I'm saying. Because we're human, oh well, there's some ego grasping there, so I'll let the pigeon just die. That's the difference. So you have to be honest with yourself, and I think that's really important with your practice. You can't go, oh yes, look, I'm a really holy person, but because there was that intention there as well. But that's not a bad thing, right? If I give a present to someone and they say thank you, I'm going to feel okay about that. That doesn't take away from the generosity. It takes away from the generosity if I go, oh well, I'm going to give that person a present, but I hope they really give me a bigger present, because I don't really value what I've given them, and it's not about making them happy, it's about getting more from it. I wasn't doing it completely from that reason. The reason I saved the pigeon really was to save the pigeon's life, and I had an opportunity of creating some positive karma, because, you know, frankly, I realised in the past I'd created some negative karma. And the causes of negative karma could put me in a state where I may not be able to create positive karma in the future. If I get a very bad, if, you know, and you look at people who are in extreme suffering, and it's very, very hard for them to create positive karma. So the more, the higher rebirths we can get, and the more positive rebirths we can get, the more effective that we can be in our lives. You look at people like Bill Gates. Did he create Microsoft for himself? Absolutely. Is he doing fabulous stuff with his money? Absolutely. Let's all become Bill Gates and go out there and do fabulous stuff. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, we have to live within society. Go on.
I wasn't asking you because I wanted to accuse you.
No, it's fine. But I'm happy to answer that. And I didn't see it as an accusation, but it's quite a valid comment, because we have to look at this. The thing I liked about Buddhism is it's very much about looking at the reality of things within our own context. It's not about going, oh, we'll just gloss over that, or we'll gloss over this. It's about actually coming to terms with our own reality. And when you do that, you can go, well, is that an honest decision? What does that have in it? Does that become grasping? Am I doing this from a grasping point of view? And so this is the practice of mindfulness, where we sharpen our minds to go, okay, what's that angle? It's like a situation happened where I was able to give 20 cents back to a post office because the guy had given me too much money. And he said to me, God, no one ever does that. And I said, yeah, but I didn't want to have it on my head. I didn't want to run around thinking that I'd ripped it off, and it was no big deal to give 20 cents back. But I realised, for my mind, to hold on to the 20 cents would have actually been a burden for my mind. And this is what I mean about Buddhism, recognising those karmas, even the small ones, that become a burden on your mind. It's like they say, you know, liars have to have incredibly good memories. You know, and a person that lies also is always in a state of agitation. You know? In fact, there was a situation where I was massaging this woman in her house and the phone rang and she said, "Oh, just pick up the phone and tell them I'm out." And she's lying there and I went, "Oh, and so do I tell them I'm the burglar?" And she went, "Well, no." I said, "Well, who do I say I am?" She said, "Well, just tell them I'm out." I said, "No." I said, "I can tell them you can't come to the phone." You know? "Oh, who are you?" "Oh, nobody." You see what I mean? I said, "We can also choose not to pick the phone up." She went, "Oh, that's a good idea." So, you know, you don't have to be... I've actually said to my teacher once, I asked him a question, did someone, I forget what it was, and he said, "I'm not telling you." I went, "Oh, okay." He didn't lie. He said, "I'm not telling you that. I'm not giving you that answer." So we do have that option. As someone else rang me up one time and they said, "Oh, look, if you..." And the reason I'm doing this is because this is just personal experience, and sometimes it helps when we're talking about things, particularly in lectures, if you get a personal experience is interesting for people because it relates to ourselves. Anyway, this person rang me up and they said, "Look, I'm going to tell you something, and if so-and-so asks you whether I've told you, can you tell them that I didn't tell you?" And I said, "You've actually asked me to lie for you." She said, "Yeah, yeah." I said, "Well, I'm not going to lie for you." I said, "So it's your choice whether you want to tell me." She said, "I think I'm not going to tell you." I said, "There you go. You've solved my problem and your problem." You know, it was kind of gossip that she wanted to tell me, and what was the point of it? You know, so, in a sense, I gave her the option of not telling me, and then I didn't have to go and tell a lie for it. You know, and so, the more we focus on that, then the more we're purifying our karma as we go along. So we can do it moment by moment. We can check out what our mind is thinking and find out whether it's creating positivity or negativity. There was a situation years ago, and I thought this was fabulous, and this was a real lesson for me. I used to live in Bowral, 2 hours out of Sydney, and I used to drive through the countryside from Campbelltown up to the city. And there were all these beautiful rolling hillsides, and one day they started putting houses all over the hillsides. And I remember saying to someone, "Oh, it's just terrible. You know, all this beautiful country with all these houses going up on it. It's really awful." And I felt really negative about it. This one particular time, my teacher had come up from Melbourne, and I was taking him from Sydney to Bowral to do a lecture. And we're driving past, and he looks at all these houses on these real green hillsides, and he says, "Isn't it fantastic that people have homes to live in?" He said, "You know, in India, this would never happen." He said, "Isn't it great that people have these homes to live in?" And I thought, well, there you go. Here am I having a negative attitude towards something, and here's my teacher saying, "Isn't it great that people have homes to live in?" And it was really, was actually quite an important thing for me to recognise that what I think is maybe a negative attitude, what I think is a righteous attitude, actually may be quite miserly in its attitude. In other words, that there was I thinking, "Oh, I can't see my beautiful green hillsides, but all he saw was a fantastic opportunity to have for people to have a roof over their heads." And that's what I mean. This is one of the reasons why we have teachers, to wake us up, to be able to see how our minds are working. And that's fantastic, you know? If you can have a teacher that can do that for you, then it's great benefit, because you then start to you start to change the way that you act within society. I think I've told you the story here about the person who I was, the blind person who was walking down the street. Can you remember that, tell that story? Okay, here's an example of not being mindful, but not a bad intention, just not really an understanding of the situation. I was in Oxford Street and this woman was walking down the street with a cane and she dropped a parcel. And me being very quick, picked the parcel up. But she was blind. So she goes down to find the parcel and I'm going, here it is. And she said, don't do that. I went, what? She said, if you're going to pick a parcel up for a blind person, touch them on the elbow and tell them you're going to pick their parcel up. And I thought that was just a great teaching. You know, I was trying to be compassionate, but not very mindful. And she just said, no, this is the way you do it. And I thought, great. And so when I see a blind person, I either don't approach them or think to myself, if I have to approach them, I'm going to touch them and say, oh, can I help you across the street? Not drag them across the street without their name, which is not a nice way to do it. So again, it's about being mindful, and that's the way that we can improve the cause and effect, just moment by moment. And the other interesting thing about karma, and these are some of the other things, a negative action doesn't create a positive result. Now, I'm going to throw a curly one at you. A person robs a bank and they get away with the money and they're really happy about it. Robbing the bank's a negative action and yet they get pleasure out of the money. What's happened there? Negative action creating a positive result? How does that work? Well, you're actually kind of on it there. The karma of enjoying the money was not related to robbing of the bank. The experience of the enjoyment of the money was not related to the robbing of the bank. That was a result of enjoying the money. The karma of robbing the bank would ripen later. According to Buddhist view, that's the way it works. So you... Well, they hadn't worked out yet, that's right. And in fact, if they had worked out a better way of getting the money, they might have enjoyed the money anyway. The cause and conditions were actually there for them to enjoy the money. But they'd created a negative cause for that future. So, you know, 10 weeks later they got caught and the money got taken, yep?
If a dog kills a baby.
If a what?
If a dog
yes.
kills a baby, like a human baby,
yeah.
You would say that the karmic effect to that dog
Yeah, exactly.
But does that mean that, let's say, and the reason that's the case is because the dog is at a different mental state and it's not able to make the kind of
that's right.
rational...
It's still a complete karma for that dog, but it's not in the same state. And the same thing with people in a war. People in a war killing out of anger,
yeah.
right? have a much more stronger... So the intention, the stronger intention creates a stronger karmic effect.
Oh, it's the intention, not because a human being should be able to discern more about what's right and wrong.
That's true, but it's the stronger intention as well. So there's a lot of factors, not just one.
Okay.
So if I have a really strong intention to kill you with anger because of great hate, then that karmic imprint is much stronger.
What about, like, a human being
Yes.
And who hasn't had a lot of opportunities to develop their mind in terms of, like,
yeah.
and sees a baby and is having sort of anger, but it's sort of in an animal like state of mind in that sense.
In that state, unfortunately, just because the person's had a bad life doesn't actually excuse the full karma. That's the difficulty there. A dog's consciousness is not as clear and as focused, but a person living in a violent society who goes and kills a baby out of anger is still going to receive the full karmic result. And worse if the intention is bad. Just because they've had a bad life is a result of previous karma. So it's not like, oh, they've had a bad... We can certainly have more compassion. It's not about us. See, these things are not about compassion. Right? It's not about compassion. It's just cause and effect we're talking about here. It was an incredible situation. I heard a monk talking about this once. He was talking about the... do you remember the O.J. Simpson trial? Okay. He was talking about, he said, you know, everyone in America got on board. Is he guilty? We want to see him guilty. We want to see him punished. There was all this kind of huge media circus, and American people were talking about it all the time, about this guy. And do you know what this monk said? He said, that poor guy may have actually killed his wife. Isn't that an interesting line? That poor guy may have actually killed his wife. Not, oh, he deserves to suffer, but he's created a cause for incredible suffering later on. Due to the force, I've heard a Lama say that, due to the force of karma, no choice. Due to the force of karma, no choice. If you ever lose your top, you'll know exactly what I mean by that. If you ever get angry spontaneously, due to the force of karma, no choice. That's why we've got to free ourselves as much as possible to create the positive karma, so that we do have a choice. And that's really important. Do you have a question? Yeah?
No, that just brings up, I know if you saw the news recently about someone pulled up a drunk truck.
Yes.
And they opened fire.
Yeah.
To protect the money.
Yeah.
And the gentleman died.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, I put it, he's a thief, but at the same time, what a tragedy it is to see such a person die in that way for that
sure.
effect.
Yeah, sure.
I tried to explain that to my mother. My mother was Catholic.
Yeah.
She has this view of that everyone should, I don't know, I can't explain it, but maybe what she said, can you make up your own mind?
Yeah.
She said, good,
he
died in the
sea. Yeah.
And then I said, but it's a tragedy.
Yeah.
Dying.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I hear what you say. Yeah, people go, well, you see it in movies all the time. You know, baddie, goodie, goodie kills baddie, everyone goes, yay! But that person's losing their life. And does anyone know the nun Robina Courtin? Okay, yeah, you know Robina Courtin. Robina Courtin's this amazing, she's a Westerner, but she's a Tibetan Buddhist nun. And she goes and spends her life pretty much going to America and sitting with the inmates on death row who are about to be executed. So, you know, they've got a week before they die. And she said she doesn't discriminate whether they've been good people or bad people or they've created, you know, she said, obviously some of them are innocent, because 20%, according to the statistics, 20% of all Americans who have been executed were innocent. It's a pretty horrific number. In fact, there was one, I think it might have been in Arkansas, where the governor of Arkansas abolished the death penalty in Arkansas. It was one of the states, because he said, if I think that I am killing one innocent person, I can't keep that on my conscience, so I am abolishing the death penalty. And so she goes and sits with these guys and holds their hands, because they are terrified that in 1 week's time they're going to lose their life. Because the most precious thing to all sentient beings is their life. All sentient beings. From the lowliest cockroach to the spider, none of us want to die. And so she said, these guys are sitting there waiting be executed, and she sits with it and does what she can to calm their mind. And a thing that someone sent to me, and it was like a little girl was talking, I've got it on my computer, it says, if killing is the worst thing that a human can do, why do good people kill bad people that have killed people? which is capital punishment. Why do good people kill bad people that are pure people? It's not logical. Yeah, and people think that revenge is going to make them happier. Your phone again. Well, at least we only got one. So, you know, in America, there is a group that actually have actively forgiven. There's a group that's got together that actually goes out and forgives the prisoners that have created the suffering. And one woman, one woman's daughter was killed by a guy when this guy was 19. I heard the story too. I heard him talk. When he was 19 years of age, he was high on crack. He broke into this girl's apartment, steal something. He had a gun with him and he shot her. He was off his face. He shot her. And he went to prison for life. And the mother of that daughter decided to go and see the monster that had killed his daughter after a number of years. She wanted to really go and see where this guy was at, you know, this vile person. And she said what she found was this young man who for 15 years, I think it was before, had regretted every minute of that action. And she befriended him, and she actually became friendly with him. And she said, when she forgave him and became friendly, she said the suffering of her daughter's death had gone. And she almost replaced this guy as someone that she could help. He was never going to get out. They threw away the key. But he said it was an act of a 19-year-old. He never meant it really to happen in that way. And so in a funny sort of way, his intention was not to kill someone, but, and in a funny sort of way, he was actually given some absolution by this mother. And she formed a big group. She then formed a group. It was, I can't remember what the name of it was, you know, Prisoner Forgiveness or something like that. And people started joining, and the ones that forgave had much greater peace than the ones that executed their revenge. They were far more at peace. Because revenge doesn't actually, and people said, revenge doesn't bring their loved ones back, so what's the point? And thankfully, in this country, we've abolished the death penalty. How are we going for time? Oh, gosh, it's getting away from us. Okay. These are just some of the just the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path of the actions that we can do that will create the causes and effects. Right-mindedness. So the more we free ourselves of negative thought and agitation, and this is where meditation comes in, the more peaceful our mind is, the less chance we have of being agitated, the less chance we have of being agitated, the less chance we may have of making wrong decisions. You never make a rational decision when you're freaked out and agitated. Out of an agitated mind comes anger, hatred, negativity. Out of a peaceful mind comes compassion, love, understanding, good business judgment, good exams. Has anyone ever done an exam in a panic? Yeah, of course, everyone has. Usually doesn't come out that well, does it? When our mind is very clear and peaceful, it usually... I mean, we just look at it. It's really, really, really obvious. The more peaceful you can have your mind, that happier existence is, and the more benefit you are to others. Absolutely. So right mind is right speech, what you say to people. Right action, obviously, what you're doing. Right living, looking at your function and how you live. And right effort, of course, right concentration. And the 10 non-virtues, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, idle, gossip, covetousness, malice and wrong view. Gossip's a beauty. Gossip is the technique where we talk about others and try and influence people about our superiority about that other person. Do you think they're honest? Oh, yeah, they're quite honest. Oh, yeah, well, yes, well, they're quite a nice person. That's gossip. We're already starting to colour the view of that person. Now, you can be honest. If you know someone's a thief, you might suggest someone doesn't lend them their life savings. That's not gossip. That's smart thinking. But it's when we create this situation of chatting about someone to influence that person to making them feel negative about them. And that's where gossip really can be quite harmful. So we talk about that person and say, oh yes, well, they're not really a good person and they do this and they do that. And quite often, and you find in gossip, is that the facts aren't quite true at that point. There's information being given that is incorrect about that person, but the other person ends up believing it. And that's where that becomes very, very damaging. So we've got to watch that one. How do you stop creating these karmas? You make a choice for one day and say, okay, for today, I'm not going to gossip, and then see what happens. Or today, I've decided I am going to be patient and not get angry. And try it out, because it's a really good exercise. If you want to do something, just do it for a small period of time. If you find it's important, if you want to remove, how can I say, purify various karmas, is to find out what karmas are your most negative ones. Maybe it's having a short temper, you know, being on short with. Maybe it might be gossip. Maybe it, you know, whatever. So if you find one that you think is a bit of a problem, then try the opponent to it for half a day or a day and just see what happens to your mind. Believe it or not, you will make slip-ups, but you will also feel incredibly empowered in your life when you do that. Yep. Short temper. Patience. You can do it, really. So if you have a short temper, pick an hour for one day and say, okay, for this 1 hour, I'm going to watch really clearly and not become angry. Now, you might lose it twice or three times, but guaranteed you'll be able to stop yourself a couple of times. So patience is the antidote to anger. Chilling out about it. Because what patience does is it gives a gap between the action that's done to us and our reaction. Yeah, okay. But, okay, do it for 3 or 4 hours. Something will happen, guaranteed. Someone will step on your toe, or, you know, or you're waiting in a line. I mean, classic example. Okay, well, give us an instance then. Come on. What do they do? What do they do to really push your buttons? Come on. Out with it.
Well, actually, it kind of happened today. Because today I was here and you were having lunch.
Yeah.
At this area stuff. And I think this is going to be a longer one to order because we had a bit of confusion with me.
Yeah.
And then the lady who was taking our order, she got quite annoyed.
Yeah.
At last, she could have got annoyed. I got a good one.
Oh, right. Okay, so let's this is great. Let's dissect this. When she was getting angry,
yes.
What went through your mind?
I was thinking, like,
how could you do that to me? Have a think about getting angry with someone. This is a really important point. I'm glad you brought this up. You can only be angry with someone if you feel superior to them. Think about it. How could she do this to me? I'm the paying customer, and the menu was confusing, and how dare she get angry? Well, she'd broken a foot that morning, she'd spilt coffee on herself, she was feeling incredibly frustrated. 7 people before you got there did exactly the same thing, and she wasn't really in control of her emotions. and her mother was sick and she was going home to a sick baby. But don't worry, you get angry at her because she should have known better. Do you see the point I'm making? If we know the full parameter of where people are coming from, or you could have said, oh, I'm really sorry for taking so long, and diffuse the situation. We have time, but it's that, and I'm not blaming you for getting angry, that's just the way it was, you know, it's gone now. But if in the instance where you constantly go, oh, how can they do that to me? If you just stop and go, actually, I won't go there now. Because it is a thinking process, isn't it? You go, oh, well, it was a confusing menu and I'm in a hurry and it's taken a long while. You know, we do go through it and then we build up this kind of file of why we can be justifiably angry at them. So I'd suggest you go to that place every day for lunch and see how it goes.
I actually, after we finished ordering, and I thought, I actually went up to her. At the beginning, I thought she was going to be really angry and confront her.
You thought she was going to lose it. Yeah, go on. And
I actually went
over
there and I started asking her, like, is everything okay? And I said, well, I'm really sorry that you feel like annoyed because you look at me annoyed.
Yeah, no, I get the point. Yeah, no, I can hear that. But still, what happened?
And then later on, like, she actually apologized to me. Like,
she apologized to you?
Yeah, she apologized.
She said,
I'm really sorry.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand. You were going to, have I upset you?
Yeah, but
it seems like it's kind of not like, oh, I'm sorry I've upset. Have I upset you? Like, what's wrong with you? Yeah, I get it. But she diffused the situation and said, I'm sorry. You know. But look, that's what I'm talking about. Those are the interactions that are important. Not the big things, but the little things. And, you know, next time, you can go, okay. Like some people get really impatient in standing in queues. Really pushes their buttons. However, has everyone travelled to a foreign country and had to stand in line for a queue? What do? You go, oh, it's a foreign country. Just stand in line. In our own country, oh, why are they taking so long in the bank? You know? And it's the same queue, in a sense. It's the same wait. But in some circumstances, oh, I'm in Italy, yeah, the bus queues, oh yeah, the bus queues in Italy are dreadful, you have to wait for an hour, right? Or in the bus queue I went in, I had to wait for ages, and I get up to the thing, I did laugh about this, and I said to the guy, this was in the days before the euro, I said, how much is the bus ticket? He said, 2,000 lira. Okay, pull that 2,000 lira, I walk away and the bus ticket says 900 lira. And I went, and then the lines moved on. And I went, he just stuck me for 1,100 lira. And there's absolutely no way, if I get back in the line and start from scratch, he's going to say, no, I didn't do that. So I just thought, oh, that was actually quite clever. I mean, 1,100 lira wasn't very much money, but it was just interesting the way I got ripped off. But the line that I was standing in, you know, probably in Australia, if I was in a hurry, because I had important things to do in Australia, when I'm travelling it's not important, could have caused me frustration. But there was no difference. The line's the line. And so we take, particularly with anger, we take on a view of arrogance. How could they do that? I would never do that. Rubbish, we all do that. You know? Yep. Well, it's still, in a sense, we still have to come, yeah, it's different expectations, yeah, but we still have to come from a superior view. Have to really think about it. A monk put this to me ages ago, and I really thought about this, and I do. When I get angry with someone, it's like, oh, how could they do that? Right? I got angry with someone the other day in the car. It was really quite frustrating. I was trying to turn right, and this woman was in a queue, but there was room, and she was huge four-wheel drive, and she's reading the paper. And I'm going, She's reading the paper and I couldn't get round. Yeah, I got a bit hassled about that one. And I thought, how could you read the paper while you're driving the car? See, again, I was, how could you do that? You see what I mean? That's the point I'm making. Yeah, different expectation, absolutely. I would expect that if they're driving their car, they're not going to sit in the middle of an intersection reading the paper. So, you know, some of them say, well, that was justifiable anger. But really, when I thought about it, no, it wasn't. I wasn't actually in a hurry. It was, how could you do that? And so that was the point that I'm making. That was where I could have stepped back, and I didn't. I got annoyed. I mean, I didn't get furious. But there was certainly a degree of agitation about my attitude. And then I drove on and I thought, I probably could have handled that actually better. You know? So these are the things I'm talking about. You know? Just those subtleties that we have in daily life is where we can change things. Now, guaranteed, that woman will turn up in my life in that four-wheel drive at some point, reading the paper again in an intersection. And I have to start from scratch again and purify it by not getting angry. You know? I've just created the karma for her to turn up again. Yeah?
Why did this go to the next story?
It's when you say that, and I realise what you're saying in terms of... Yeah, when I say nothing's happening, that's... No, hold it.
You're simply saying, someone's jumping up and down and yelling at you, but you realize that you're projecting the entire thing from your own mind.
Absolutely, but
everything you're thinking about that person is not in that person, it's in your head.
You can come...
I'm realizing saying there's nothing happening, you can't possibly... You're saying there's really nothing here.
That's true, but what I'm actually saying... I hear what you're saying there, and that is quite a highly refined view of it. Because I can say, I'm empty, the situation's empty, and the person in the car is empty, so therefore there is nothing to be upset about. However, I went through the experience of not being happy about it. So I had absolutely negated the clarity of that thinking. The point you were saying about, and which earlier about the purifying of the karma with the bird, if I could see the bird, and this is actually a process that you do, and if you can come from this angle, this is fantastic. This is even beyond the level of patience. If you see that the cause, the action, and the result are all empty, then there's no attachment to it. And they say that if you can give a gift with the three emptinesses, then that gift is a pure gift. So yes, absolutely agree with it. If I give a gift to someone, I see the receiver is empty, the gift of empty and inherent existence, and myself giving the gift of empty of inherent existence, then I can give a gift much more purely than I can give it a thing. But that's a very difficult place to come from naturally, because karmically we don't often come from that angle. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely you can do that, but if you come from the position of emptiness, you have no attachment to even that happiness. Alright? And then you can dedicate the action of that gift to the enlightenment of sentient beings and actually give away the happiness that you've had to sentient beings. This is the thing about Buddhism, it's quite amazing on the different levels of understanding that you can work with your mind. This is the most incredible thing, that you can come from that angle that Paul mentioned, or you can come from, okay, well, I'm just going to be patient with this, because that's a way of working with it. And so you can work within your own capacity. And the Buddha, this is why the Buddha gave 84,000 teachings to cover the 84,000 delusions that we keep tripping ourselves up with. And he can come from this angle and that angle and this angle. And there's quite an amazing array. The Buddha taught for 50 years, so he gave 50 years of possibilities of how to purify our existence so that we can become more beneficial for ourselves and others. I think we're pretty much finished. Is there any last questions at all? I think we've pretty well done it. I know I've digressed, it's spun around, but I hope you found it interesting. I have. Thank you all for your input. I've learned stuff. and see you next time.